Would you like to reach our film and TV review podcast audience? Do you have a product or service of interest to film and TV home consumers or followers of the entertainment industry? Have a film or show production to publicize? For affordable price plans for all budgets, get in touch and find out about our introductory advertising options. Reach our audience of film and TV viewers and visit our site contact page at filmandtvreview.com, or you can email us at business@filmandtvreview.com. Reach out today. Welcome to filmandtvreview.com. Catch the latest film, TV, and streamed show reviews every week. The views and opinions expressed by the authors and those providing comments are theirs alone. They do not reflect the views, opinions or position of filmandtvreview.com or their respective parent companies or affiliates. Filmandtvreview.com makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, suitability, or validity of any information in this program and is for entertainment purposes only. Episodes may contain adult humor and language. For full terms and conditions, see filmandtvreview.com.
Hello and welcome to this film and TV review special. And of course, we're covering the Oscars, the 96 Oscar ceremonies, which will be coming up the next week. And I thought we'd talk with our regulars, hosts, about what we think about the list. It's been quite a high quality year, actually, surprisingly. I'm joined by our regulars, Richard, Alfonso, Andrew and James, and hello. And we'll go through each nominee, and then we'll have your views on that. So we'll kick off with first one, of course, is American Fiction. Most of you have seen this, so what's your first thoughts on that? And that making it onto the list.
Okay. Can I?
Yeah, Richard, yeah, please.
That's the last one I've seen in the list. I've seen all of them, obviously, but yeah, that's the last one I've seen only last week. And I think it completely deserves to be on that list. Interesting idea of this movie about a writer. Played by, obviously now, I forgot his name.
Jeffrey Wright.
Thank you. And his struggle, let's say, actually, to either write what he wants or what the people want. Let's put it this way. And what I really like is that this movie is about so many things at the same time, but it doesn't feel like actually that it's messy storylines. It's kind of balanced between his personal life, between his personal life of his mother who was diseased and who is getting old, about his family's issues, his brother, especially, who is played by Sterling K. Brown, who is doing an amazing job. And at the same time, the other story, as I was saying, is his struggles as a writer. And I think this movie addresses so many things with humor, which is not easy, to be honest, because it addresses important things about, especially the society in the US, about the African-American community, how it is represented in medias and the stereotypes and the cliches, and it could have been a very difficult subject to talk about, but I think they do it very well. Or not the cast, but also the guy who actually wrote it. I think he's the same guy as the director, if I'm not mistaken. Jefferson, his name is, I think. So yeah, it's a smart movie in a nutshell. Funny at some times, quite emotional on the other point. Something I'm gonna say quite often in today's recording is that although it's a great movie, because of a year that is full of great movies, I think it doesn't stand a chance to get the Best Picture award. It doesn't mean that it's a bad movie. Just actually, but I think that it's a very strong year for Academy Awards, in my opinion. So let's hope actually he's going to get something, or at least some recognition, so people can see it. Yeah.
Any others share that thought or saw that? No.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I've seen the film. I think
Yeah.
I agree with Richard. I think it's really funny, really smart film. It's up for adapted screenplay, so it's adapted from a book, and I think it is one of the smartest scripts. I would probably go between this and Barbie for adapted screenplay win. Jeffrey Wright is really good in it, but he's quite a sort of guarded character, and his brother Sterling, played by Sterling K. Brown in this, much more he wears his heart on his sleeve. And I think he's not really in the film that much, but when he is, he really kind of steals every scene he's in. And I watched this before the nominations come out, and I thought he does deserve a supporting actor nod, but I don't know if he'll get it because he's not in it that much. So I'm really pleased that he has got that. And I would echo what Richard says. I think it's a really strong year when you look at all the sort of categories and the nominations this year. But yeah, I'm very jealous that Richard has got this film on Amazon Prime that he can just rewatch at his leisure.
I also have it in
The best
Spain.
things come to those who wait, right? But yeah, it's not even really had that wider release, UK release. But it's a very funny film. It's sort of one of those films. I was speaking to someone about this when they said, oh, it probably won't win Best Picture. And they were talking about, like, oh, the cinematography is kind of basic. And it's like, yeah, it is, but it feels like it needs that. Like, it would be really weird if this film had this amazing cinematography, because it's so much about the script and the sort of social commentary, I think. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. And although it's very funny, it's very sad and tender in places. I think Alfonso said it's kind of like it's got that social satire, but it's also this relatable family drama as well. So yeah, I
Yeah,
really love it.
I didn't expect I expected the satire, but I didn't expect the tender, let's say, more tender family drama, and the drama itself. It caught me by surprise, because I had seen a little bit of the trailer, and it looked funny to me. The Jeffrey Wright's the desperation when he finds how the literary world works, in the sense of what. The kind, why he is classified as a black author in the bookshops, and it's although he writes about classical figures and stuff like that, it's interesting to see how that develops. But it's other movies would have taken that as their whole plot, and this movie kind of mixes it with more. Let's say more drama, yeah, and more character study and family study. It's kind of like that genre of person who is down on their luck and goes back to their hometown and meets their family, and comes back to his roots or their roots, and there is maybe a new love interest in town, that kind of thing. That whole plot development of that subgenre, kind of like Sandra Bullock in Hope Floats. I wasn't expecting that. It has both, and both work. I mean, everything works.
Yes, well, I'm popular. And right, anyone else want to chip in on who's seen that before we move on? Okay, so next, got a courtroom drama on murder mystery almost. Anatomy of a Fall. I know, Richard, you
Vive la France,
quite
vive
a
la
champion.
France.
Yeah, you were quite a champion of this.
And
I'm biased, of
Germany, and
course.
Germany as well, I guess.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I will not overspeak. I just say actually it's one of my favorite movie of the year, but I spoke a lot about Anatomy of a Fall, that Anatomy and shoots the original version a couple of times in these recordings. So yeah, I really enjoy that movie. And again, it's not me saying, yeah, well, it's French, so it's good. No, I can criticize and be very negative about French cinema, but in that case, actually, it's a very well done movie. It's very impressive what they could have done with, in the end, just a very small and very short pitch at the end, at the beginning, sorry. Kind of, yeah, it's a murder mystery, but then after 10 minutes, it becomes so much more and managed to do something like about family and about, yeah, about. Not trying to go into spoiler territory here, but yeah, about identity almost. And no, it's yeah. I said I won't talk much about this one, and but I really like it. I don't know if he's gonna get the Best Picture award. It would be amazing, but if he does, for me, it's in like maybe the top three favorites in my opinion. But I don't know. Again, it's a strong year, so who knows.
Anyone else managed to catch a batting for four?
I mean, I like very much this kind of genre. So to me, it was surprising that one movie of this genre, like it was so well received in Cannes and everywhere, and especially by reviewers who might have thought, well, this is a some kind of did she do it? Did she not do it? And it's interesting to analyze why this one is more accepted by the critics. And I think it's because, yeah, because it goes deeper into the characters, or it gives you the drama of the child also in puts it in the in the first like it doesn't it, it almost the child has almost as much weight as the mother in this film. I and of course the acting is very good. It has a very European flavor with Sandra Hüller and all the French actors, and it has become somewhat iconic. I saw in the Independent Spirit Awards that at some point the presenter was interrupted by a song that sounded very much like the song that sounds at the beginning of this film when she's interrupted in the interview with her husband who's playing that song full volume. The presenter of the Independent Spirit Awards was like, wait a second, I have to go kill my husband. Oh, no, that's, she didn't say it like that. Anyhow, it was a good joke. And the dog has become very iconic, and these little things. So yeah, I also enjoyed it a lot. I it's it, with as with Lady Bird and the team movies, I wonder what does it make this so well received, but it's because I very much enjoy both genres, I guess.
Yeah, quite did kind of catch a kind of slow burn, and then word of mouth really spread on this one, definitely. Got 5 nominations: Best Picture, Actress, Original Screenplay, and film editing. So yeah, we'll see. Anyone else catch that? No? Yeah,
Yeah,
anyone?
I think it's a good number of nominations as well. It's nice to see it. I think there was a point where Richard was saying because there's some political aspect, there was rumors that it wasn't going to get put forward, but it's a good number of nominations, I think. Actress, I mean, the actress category is really strong this year. I would be very happy if it's Sandra Hüller for this film because she carries so much of the film in two languages. I mean, I'm saying that Richard does this podcast in a second language, as does Alfonso. I couldn't. I can barely speak English.
And where's our Oscar? Nowhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Where's our award? Yeah.
You might get an honorary one that's just not said in advance. But I mean, she's fantastic in this movie. Although Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon and Emma Stone for Poor Things, I'd be very happy with those people getting that as well. Original screenplay, it's in the same category as Past Lives. Now, I would be just as happy for this. I really love Past Lives. I know Richard likes it as well. So, but I think these are really, really good original scripts. So either of those I'd be happy with. Let's be honest, it's not going to get Best Picture or Director, I don't think. But yeah, a best dog performance. Alfonso's right. They need to make a category for that because it's an amazing dog performance.
Indeed. Well, from our European flavor to
the little anecdote. The last time a French movie won the Best Picture, it was something like, I don't know, 12 or 13 years ago with Jean Dujardin, the artist.
Oh, the artist. Yeah.
And funny enough, there was also a very famous dog in that movie.
Yeah, but nobody thought of that.
It was like a little dog.
As a French picture. Like it was a French picture, but masked as a Hollywood picture.
Yeah, because it was produced by who does not be names, but yeah.
Well, as we're talking an American flavor, our next nominee is Big American Toy Story, let's say. It's Barbie. That was really the event of this, you know, in box office numbers setting this year. Andrew, did you manage to catch Barbie and were you swept away? And does it deserve a Best Picture nomination?
Yeah, I mean, it showed up in a lot of critics and other precursor awards. So I think it was a case where a couple of the snubs this year were kind of like, they pointed to Barbie, like, you know, where's Greta Gerwig in Best Director? Where's Margot Robbie in Best Actress? Although I guess they both are in it as producers of the film in that way. But yeah, I mean, I think what it was a good film. I guess what made it work is that, you know, where do you take the story and what do you do with it? And what kind of story do you even do? I mean, it's not like an inherent story that you could just, I mean, it's an adapted screenplay, but it's not adapted from a particular story. So they take like this theme of gender roles and you know, where do women fit in and more roles for women and stereotyping and the patriarchy and all these different issues. And also with corporate involvement, you know, you have like the corporation and their involvement and, you know, trying to say, you know, this is what we want or don't want. And, I guess what really made the film work, I mean, yeah, Margot Robbie was the lead main character, I guess, but it was a whole speech of America. And she gives a speech in the film that gets played a lot on the internet. And that's kind of what the film is sort of like, you know, why are things so difficult for women versus men? And she kind of explains it in the speech in the film. Yeah, she's talking about the Barbie dolls, but there's a lot more going on. So again, it could have just been a just basic story, but they made it more complex, which isn't really that much of a surprise. It's from Greta Gerwig. So this wasn't someone who just, oh, we're going to do a mainstream film. She'd done like Little Women, like her version of Little Women, and Lady Bird. And as an actress, she did a lot of like indie films. So she's done a lot of different things. It's not mainstream what people would expect, but it was mainstream release and people could enjoy it just as sort of entertainment, but there was also a depth to it. So, I mean, I don't know if it's going to win much in terms of awards simply because there's just too many other strong contenders in the other categories. Like in the other categories, it's like, oh, this was going to win or that's going to win. I'm not sure about adapted screenplay. Who's a front runner there? But in the other categories, there's at least one other film or one other performer who I could say, oh, yeah, that person's going to win. So that's just the way it kind of works. So, yeah, it's a decent film. It has entertainment value, but it's also got its own message. So, yeah, that's my thoughts on it.
I would say also that it has also has a replayability factor that is pretty big. I mean, it was proved by the box office, but I've also experienced it like watching it a second time. It's one of those films that some people just, I think, will return again and again because it's like this, like Barbie world where some people would like to stay, and it's just it has times where it's funny and it has times where it's touching, and I think it's a movie that can be played again and again and again for some people, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else kind of like enjoy it or think it really does work?
I just want to reply to one thing that Ando was saying, is that in this category of best adapted screenplay, I'm just looking at it now, I don't see any competition for Avi except Oppenheimer. Because Oppenheimer is obviously from the book, but he's kind of famous as well. So yeah, I think it's one of the two.
The one that is winning everything so far is American Fiction, actually.
Hmm.
Is it the favorite in that category?
American Fiction. Really? American Fiction, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's weird. It even won at the BAFTAs, like out of the blue, nothing else.
Okay.
Well, I think it's a kind of way to balance things out, to kind of give something to everyone kind of thing. So rather than have one film sweep all the awards, they kind of spread the wealth, so to speak.
Yeah, and the scripts usually sometimes go for like the new, or the script that is from someone new, that it kind of is like it's something that usually tends to go to new screenwriters that are discovered, let's say, like Cord Jefferson.
It's a question for you both, actually, because you mentioned that, Andrew and Afonso, or even James and Jason. But recently, what is kind of the trend, let's say? Does the Academy try to do what you just said, Andrew, try to make everyone happy, let's say, and try to give awards everywhere? Or does clean sweep, let's say, do happen anymore? Or you know what I mean?
Not so much. No, each award is different for like what voters. I mean, for example, picture and director have been different this past 10 years many times.
And then it's not even, it's like other categories too. Like it used to be more like one film win a bunch of awards. Now it's like a few here, a few there. Yeah.
I think as well, it depends on, I've heard people who vote for these things saying, in a perfect world, you would watch everything, but sometimes you don't have the time. So it tends to be weighted more towards the bigger films, the one that has 11 nominations. Everyone's going to watch that one. They're not going to watch something that's just nominated for, you know, best costume or something like that. So people might end up voting, because when I was looking down this list, I mean, I still haven't seen everything in every category, you know, and some of the things I'm not even aware of or where I'd find them. I think as well, it does feel that things are getting the right sort of recognition generally. I mean, we'll talk about one of them when we get to it. Maestro's up for original screenplay. I've got things to say on that. But, you know, I think when you look at the special effects category this year, it looks like the five films with the best effects, doesn't matter what the rest of the film is like, it is the films with the best effects that they've chosen. So I think maybe they're doing a bit more of that, whether people actually vote for it or not. And there might be a thing that people kind of vote for something because they think everybody else is voting for the other one. I don't know how much there is of knowing what your friends vote for and things. And also, there is often, I know it's a good thing to look at the Golden Globes and the BAFTAs as an indication of where the voting might go. But the one thing that always sticks in my head when people talk about the Oscars is the year where Moonlight won Best Picture. And La La Land was up for everything. No, Moonlight was not on anybody's radar. And obviously there was that thing where they announced that it was La La Land and it wasn't. They'd read out the wrong card and it was Moonlight. So you could very well have something on the night that everyone's expecting it to be Oppenheimer, and you could have something just out of the blue everyone votes for. I think American Fiction's and Barbie are really good shouts for the screenplay. And I'm really pleased they've chosen the right two songs for Barbie as well. So it's got two, it's up against each other for two songs. The Dua Lipa song is a banger, but it's got nothing really to do with the film. So they've chosen I'm Just Ken and What Was I Made For by Billie Eilish, which when I heard that on the radio, I thought it was a good song. But when I saw it in the context of the film, I was like, this is kind of perfect for the end of the film. Really kind of sums up the themes of it. And I said it before, but American Ferrera for Best Supporting Actress, I'm really pleased they made that call, because in some ways this is her film. I think it's in some ways it's an ensemble, but I think once you get into the second half of the film, it kind of becomes like he's the focus of the film, really. So I'd be very happy for her to win that.
Yeah. Well, bit more of a low-key one, but I think one word of mouth because of the performances. It came quite late in the UK here. Yeah? That was The Holdovers. And that's a New England prep school, kind of almost like, I mentioned this, it's almost like their Breakfast Club meets the Dead Poets Society, if you want a bit of a film shorthand. It's a kind of like a nice little kind of focus for a good ball. Yeah, Matty, I think, as a good character actor, but his character takes a just age here. James, you saw this, and
yeah, and it's my favourite sort of film that's been released in 2024 in the UK that's on this list, if that makes sense. I've been trying to order. It's been a really strong January in the UK. We get all these films a lot later than the US. In the case of this, it's weird because it's set at Christmas, so we got it in January, just after Christmas was over. But I don't think it matters. It's a, I think it's a really lovely script, up for original screenplay. I was just talking about America Ferrera getting supporting actress, but I think Divine Joy Randolph probably really deserves this for best supporting actress. It's a really great role she's got in this. So yeah, I really love the film. I think it's a great thing. I do think it's going to be Cillian Murphy gets best actor, but Paul Giamatti for this is surely going to give him a run for his money. I don't think it will go to him. I think it will be Cillian Murphy, but he's really great in this film, really great. And again, a very, very funny film, but a very touching film as well.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it actually came quite late in the year, but then still some great word of mouth on his performance. But
I think it's up for editing as well, which it definitely deserves. Like the way it looks, it's shot digitally, but it looks like it's shot on film. So it's got this real sort of grainy look to it. And it, I think if you just turn this on, you would think this is a film from the 70s. It really does feel like that. So, and some, not all films do. Like Napoleon, I never believe we're back there when you watch Napoleon. It looks like a film shot now. There's no, and it looks like they've got a lot of wigs, but I don't believe I'm there. With this, I really believe I'm back in the 1970s. I'm sure someone's going to say, oh, but did you spot that car number plate or something? I don't care. I believed it, and I loved it.
Yeah, I think the other thing too is the trailer. I don't know if you've seen the trailer, but I guess the trailer looks like something that was like a trailer for something from the 70s where there's like a voiceover, you know, something you don't see in more recent trailers.
Yeah, it's even got voiceover guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and also the opening credits for The Holdovers look like the opening credits from a 70s film, and they even have like the date in Roman numerals that gives it as like 1971 or something like that. I mean, it's not a 1971 film, obviously, but they actually stick that in there, so you like almost believe that you're watching a film from the 70s.
It even comes up. I'll ask you this actually, Andrew, because I assume they've done this differently in every country, but I know this is real geek stuff now. But it comes up with a BBFC card saying it's rated 15, as it has to. But then when the film starts, it's got the old BBFC card when it would have been rated an A adult film in the 70s. And they put that, and I was like, they must do that differently for every country, put in like the old style.
Oh, that could be.
Might have missed that, but yeah.
I mean, guess in the old style. I mean, I don't think the ratings have really changed in the US with regards to that, but I mean, a little bit, but I think this would probably, I think it's rated R. I'm not sure. If we're rated PG-13, that would be a different story. But getting to saying, or what James was saying earlier, is that this was, I guess, released, I guess, in November in the US, but there are a lot of times where in the past film, some of the Oscar films would get released in New York City and LA, because that's really all they're required to do is get released in those two cities. That's where a lot of Academy members live. And then they'd start to make their way to other parts of the US in the beginning of the following year. Not even talking about the rest of the world, just talking about within the US itself. So, but I think in this case, it was actually released in November, but it only maybe played for like a couple of weeks or so. And then it just kind of disappeared from cinemas. It wasn't like big financial success. I mean, for what it is, I guess it's successful that way, but it's not like, didn't have a big budget per se, but it's not something that really was in cinemas for like a while.
Yeah.
So,
same year.
I managed to catch it.
1 week release in France.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's understand because it's from another country, but still, you would expect in the US to be longer than just like a couple of weeks. But I guess because there were so many other films, though, can't really imagine what. The Marvels, maybe, or Hunger Games, I don't know. But I thought the film was really good. I think also with regards to the acting, at this point, a lot of the categories are kind of set in terms of, you know, who's going to win and not holdovers, not Marvels. Yeah. But the thing with the best actor category, I think it seems like Cillian Murphy is going to win, but I guess there's a lot of sentiment towards Paul Giamatti because he was only nominated once, and that was sort of to make up for him not getting nominated. Basically, people expected him way back in the day, way back, to get nominated for Sideways. They presumed he would be, but he wasn't nominated for Sideways, which also was from the same, you know, from this director, Alexander Payne. He got nominated the following year for Best Supporting Actor for Cinderella Man. So this is really his first nomination in Best Actor category. And a lot of people feel like, you know, it's his time, he's really due. But yeah, it's a good performance, but it's tough. You know, it's with anything else. As a little side note, there may be that possible in the Best Actress category, but I haven't really heard that as much. Paul Giamatti has won some precursors, but I think it seems like it's Cillian Murphy is the favorite in this category, so yes. We'll see what happens.
Another film had some big names attached to it and big directors was Killers of the Flower Moon. Came out much earlier in the year. Big name title.
Yeah.
DiCaprio, De Niro, Scorsese.
Yeah.
Yeah. The trifactor there. Was it really worth the hype, really? Or maybe just...
I think with this, it's one of those films that it was going to go onto Apple TV, wasn't it? But they sort of put it in the cinema so that it would be eligible. And it actually did better business than they were kind of expecting. And I know some people said, oh, because of the runtime, maybe it belongs on streaming rather than the cinema. I sort of disagree because I really was not expecting to like this movie as much as I was. And I find there was something just completely immersive about being in the cinema for as long as that. But I mean, probably just if it was any more than 3.5 hours, I'd probably have wanted at least a toilet break. But I was completely engrossed by it. I think it's kind of amazing he's done a film this good this late in his career. I think it's much better than The Irishman.
That's for sure.
And there's some really great performances in it. I mean, so much of it is Leonardo DiCaprio, but basically it's kind of his film, really. And he's not actually nominated for Best Actor for this. But Lily Gladstone, I think, for Best Actress is great. A great gal. Robert De Niro for Supporting Actress. I think maybe the score as well. This is a really good score. This and Oppenheimer, I think, are probably the two. But the guy who composed the score for this, Robbie Robertson, actually passed away. So he might be a posthumous winner for this. There's also a song called A Song for My People, which is a song that's nominated for Best Original Song. And I think that might be the song that sort of wins over two of the Barbie songs, possibly. It could be one of those things where Barbie doesn't, maybe it doesn't win anything. We don't know. But yeah, I think it's really good. Really good cinematography in this film as well. And again, the period detail, I think, is fantastic. I really believe like I've been transported 100 years back in time. So I really like this film, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I was disappointed. No flowers, no moon, no flowers in the moon, no killers in the moon with flowers. But
this year's moon four then, yeah. But,
there'll be an extended universe, there always is.
Yeah. A little tidbit about, I think, what James was saying. I think, as he said, that this was something that was originally going to go to streaming, and then they decided to release it in cinemas. What happened was, at least in the U.S., because of the actors' strike, Dune 2 got pushed back. It was originally going to open October 20th, and then obviously opened much more recent than that. So that weekend, you know, there was like an open slot at cinemas and IMAX in particular. So Killers of the Flower Moon managed to open up that weekend and take those IMAX streams that would have gone to Dune 2 otherwise. Otherwise there hadn't been an actor strike, then it would have been Dune 2 that weekend. But anyway, I thought I liked the film. I know there's a lot to take in because of the 3 hours, and there's a lot of issues that were covered by the film about the treatment of the indigenous and the Osage, the tribes. And also a little bit touched on the Tulsa riots, where African Americans were attacked in the city of Tulsa in Oklahoma. So that was just touched on a little bit in the film because that was around that time period where the film takes place. So there's a lot to take away from the film. And he also has other name actors who made appearances, like Jesse Plemons, Brendan Fraser, I think some others. So kind of a lot of names in the cast. And again, DiCaprio's not in it. Yeah, John Lithgow. Yep. And DiCaprio's not nominated, but it's a tough category, best actor. Best actress could be Lily Gladstone, who wins, could be Emma Stone. It's been kind of between the two of them this season, but we'll see what happens. I know that Emma Stone won at BAFTAs, but Lily Gladstone wasn't nominated there, so we'll see what happens. And it'd be interesting, Lily Gladstone, she has like an interesting backstory, something that's been covered in her previous speeches during this award circuit. But again, we'll see what happens. So, I mean,
I just want to say something. Don't you think, Andrew, that there is one category he shouldn't appear is in the best supporting actor category? I think that if it wasn't Robert De Niro, he would not have gotten the nomination, if you know what I mean. I don't think that Robert De Niro did an amazing performance out of his world, but I don't think he deserves a nomination. That's what I'm trying.
I don't think he needs to be nominated.
I think that there are other people who should have gotten this slot as nominated. For example, the kid from the Old Overs called, I don't know his name, but now I know it, Dominic Sessa. I think he deserved more. But yeah,
is he not nominated?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, no. Even I was checking now, and I think it's it's just a name. They nominated a name, De Niro is obviously one of the greatest actors of all time. Okay, but if you just look at this movie particularly, come on. I don't know.
I would agree with you on that, I think, Richard. It's, like, I think he's fine in it, but when he dies, we're not going to go, oh, that amazing role in Killers of the Flower Moon.
Exactly.
I think his character, it's really interesting to me, like the differences in evil, because he's much more calculating as a character than DiCaprio's character. Mm. But yeah, I don't think it's like a career best performance. I think you're right. They've kind of just nominated him off the name, possibly.
Yeah.
And maybe Apple pushed for it. So I don't know. Another little tidbit is that actually the movie actually, I think, lost money because it was very expensive to put together. So it made some money, but you know, this is Apple, so it's not like a big loss for them. Most of the money is made.
I think this is a mobile weird device thing with streaming, though, now, isn't it? That this is the argument with the MCU stuff as well, where it's not taking as much money as it used to, but they say, oh, but it doesn't matter because we build this into the number of subscriptions we get from Disney Plus. But
well Disney is different.
But we don't know what those figures are, so it's very difficult for the sort of bystanders to work out how this works now.
Disney is different, though, because they still rely on their content for appeal, whereas Apple, their money is really made from I can't see it, but they're made from mobile devices and their products, the streaming, the films, the content, that's like a small percentage of, you know, their bottom line. So that it lost money and that Napoleon lost money, yeah, it's not great, but it's not going to really hurt them too much in the long run, because most of their money is made from their products, their phones or iPads or whatever products they put out. So same thing with Amazon. You know, the main thing isn't content, it's whatever Amazon does. So.
True. Yes. Interesting what the models, I can't see them all existing in the far, far future, as one of them will have to take dominance over the others, I think, or to take over, but we'll see what happens with that. But it's interesting, the very, very huge amounts of money put in these films now, actually. Right. Well, another big, you can see almost catered for best actor bid is a biography. It's Maestro. It's Bradley Cooper, armed with prosthetic nose, does the biopic of Leonard Bernstein. Did seem, pardon the pun, a little bit on the nose, as in I want an Oscar for this, but maybe who saw this, and maybe does it deserve to be in the best picture?
No.
Richard, yes.
That's it. That will be my review. No. It's the definition of an Oscar bait. That's my opinion. It's I'm sorry, but yeah. The more I think about it, the more I don't see any quality in this movie. I really don't see it. Honestly, I'm trying to see anything. And it's not like I don't like the guys who play this movie or the guy. I mean, I enjoy watching movies with Bradley Cooper. He is a decent actor. He did great stuff in the past. I mentioned several times here, but I really love Carey Mulligan's acting career. If you haven't seen Promising Young Woman, go check it out now. Again, that's the worst part. And I have nothing against the cast, but the movie itself is just so boring. It gives nothing to the audience, gives nothing, no emotion whatsoever, in my opinion. And for a movie about music, that's maybe the worst thing you can say. Music,
well, it's
or...
Sorry. Chasing Young Men. It's about Chasing Young Men.
Chasing Young Men.
More than
exactly.
Music.
Yeah. Because it's a movie about, that's the title. It's about a music composer. And bad guy, actually. I mean, art is about having emotions when you watch a movie, when you look at a painting, when you listen to music, etc. When you feel nothing watching a movie about a maestro, then there is something terribly wrong. So I have no idea what he's doing in the Oscars list, to be honest. I have no idea what it's doing here.
I think the point of the film is to focus on the relationship between Leonard Bernstein and his wife.
Yeah, but,
such as it was. So I think that was the point of the film, but I'm just...
But that's a shame, because I'm be honest with you, I kind of didn't care about this. I was hoping that at least they would do, it's a personal opinion again, I was hoping at least they would do both, at least both, actually show a bit of what he does for a living. And I think there was like one scene at best where you can see Bradley Cooper becoming something else. And everything else is true. Yeah, it's about more his family. So, yeah, I don't know.
It's about a relationship where she agrees about him being with young men and then not, and then yes, and then not, and then yes, and then yes.
I would say that I would disagree that there's nothing good about this film, but I would say that this is the definition of a film that is less than the sum of its parts. and it's that thing that I know that's probably a phrase that's a very British phrase, so I'll explain it. Like, there are good things in it, but I do find it strange that it's nominated for Best Picture and Best Screenplay, because I think those are the weakest things. And I think so many films, particularly entertainment films, we want stories, and this is not the best story. I don't know if I've been thinking a lot about this, and I won't go off on too much of a tangent, but with biopics, what do? You just tell the truth, and the truth might be quite dull, and life doesn't have like an arc or an ending necessarily. Or do you try and shape it into something like Bohemian Rhapsody? Bohemian Rhapsody does not feel like a true story at all to anybody, but they kind of tried to shape it into an arc. I do think in this, you've got really breathtaking cinematography. I think Bradley Cooper is really amazing in the different ages that he plays. Like, he's playing someone completely different. And I think I love the fact that it's in black and white and it's in this small aspect ratio, and then it goes to color later on, that it goes to widescreen. All that stuff's great, but the story's kind of boring. And that's the problem, is that you've got these good, so the phrase less than the sum of its parts, you've got these good elements, but as a whole, it's not the best picture. I'm sorry, it isn't. And it's the one nomination in this list that I kind of go, I don't think it should be there. I think it's a little bit better than maybe some people are saying, but it does feel like they've just gone, who's someone that is well known by the Academy? Exactly. Leonard Bernstein, let's do a biopic about him. And it is focused on that relationship. But you're right, Richard, I didn't feel anything emotional during this film.
That's a problem. You know? By the way, you mentioned something, and I thought about it. There is a movie by Ricky Gervais called The Invention of Lying. In that movie, there is a very funny thing, but actually he is a film writer. His job is writing movies or something like that. And it's boring because he lives in a world where you can't lie. So all the movies are about real people or real stuff. And you can see actually how the movie that he writes are so boring. At that point, they say, our new blockbuster next year will be The Invention of the Fork. And when I watched Maestro, I was thinking that. I was thinking, honestly, we live in the age where in Hollywood, they think, let's do a movie. So I'm looking at my desk. I say, oh, a book. Let's do a movie about the first guy who created the book. And you're going to do 2 hours about all the obstacles that that guy had to go through to create the first book in history. That's how dumb doing biopics is in my brain nowadays. Not everyone is worth a biopic. That's
or at least you got to shape it into something with conflict and stuff, because the thing with Leonard Bernstein is that he's successful at his job. He has an agreement with his wife about his escapades or whatever. And, well, okay. So, everything was more or less regulated and they had disagreements. They had fights like every other couple. I don't know. Give me some conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Well, also, the film is from Netflix, and I know they have some other films that are part of the Oscar, well, the Oscar conversation at least. And I know one was May, December, and the other was NIAID. They may have others, so I'm just wondering why Netflix went with this film and not those other two. Could be because of Bradley Cooper. They thought the Academy likes actor directors. And they've liked Bradley Cooper in the past, so
they were right.
Maybe that's what their mindset was. I don't know.
The Academy voters actually embraced it to a point. It's even for best original screenplay nominated. So even screenwriters voted for it, because these nominations are voted by the guilds. So screenwriters vote for the screenplay. And even the screenwriters thought that that was, should be nominated for original screenplay. I guess also Netflix does a lot of marketing to push these movies, and they get much more attention.
Yeah.
So they get more attention than other movies.
Yeah, because those other two were Netflix as well. So I was just wondering why this film and not those other two. But I guess, again, as Alfonso was pointing out, and I pointed out, the whole Bradley Cooper and that whole thing, I guess, and it seemed more Oscar baity. So that's maybe what it is. So.
Yes. Well, from one biopic to another, one that probably did do a grand job, was, of course, the big hitter this year, was Oppenheimer. Cillian Murphy in the title role, again, depicting the one of the most important points in history, the atomic bomb. This kind of like more concentrated on a working period of time in the creation of it, but then a few flash forwards and backwards and forwards, as in his life around it. What did this do right that maybe Maestro didn't do so well?
Everything. that's a whole podcast that could go on for like years. I think we should do it. As a
that's the best question one ever. That's the best question ever.
That sounds like an exam, film studies exam question. But let's say, okay, well, I mean, it's a popular choice. What did any maybe? It seems like a no-brainer.
They didn't put a big fake nose on their lead actor for a start.
And also, what I just said is that actually, Oppenheimer is definitely more important in human history than, in Maestro. I think his life is much more interesting to adapt in a movie than the guy in Maestro. That's the first thing, but in my opinion, anyway. Yeah.
It goes on to 3 hours, and 2 hours of it is this big, huge race, because I was arms race almost against the other side in creating of it, which was, I think, quite a good, tense little narrative there. And then, for me, I kind of grab my hand is that I think the third act, where it's more kind of like a denouncement of maybe, of, you know, his political leanings, or it's more months all the enemies come for him afterwards, after his biggest triumph. It's kind of like goes into this little semi faux courtroom kind of internal kind of like review of him, and maybe he's just taking off his clearance, which seems a bit, I found maybe would have been better as a series rather, but it's a good 2 hour movie. It's just that third act.
I really disagree with that, though. I think the third part is my favorite part of it. So, I mean, and that's just an opinion, but I think that's kind of what's interesting, is that you sometimes don't, because the other thing with biopics is, I agree with Richard, not everybody should have like a biopic, but it's also trying to find like the ones that are like just the rags to riches kind of stories. It's been done so many times that you need to find something that's specific. And I think the thing here about having those two timelines, one where he's kind of being used almost by the government or sort of appraised and everything, and then the point where they're kind of distancing themselves from him, the sort of juxtaposition of those two things is quite fascinating. And I think, although Cillian Murphy's fantastic, there's some really good other performances. Robert Downey Jr. Is obviously nominated for Best Supporting Actor, which I think he got at the BAFTAs. But Matt Damon, I think, is really good in this as well. So, I think it's and also the guy, is it Jason Clarke, the guy who's in the court at the end?
He's very good.
Yeah, he's very good in those scenes. But I think it's one of those films that Christopher Nolan was sort of saying about, and he has these amazing scripts, but he said that Hollywood is often too concerned about the plot, and you do need a plot and a story, and that's why we go to things. But I think at the cinema, you also want the sort of visual spectacle of it. And with this, it really does feel like, even though it's quite, you could look at the script and think it's quite dry, I think it manages to be this really good sort of visual experience. And the sound, I think, is fantastic. Although I don't know if that will get won potentially by one of the other films this year, but I think the sound on it is really good. What's the other film? There was another film. I'll have a look which one I thought might steal. Oh, Zone of Interest. We'll come to that. But Zone of Interest will probably win the sound, but the sound is amazing, I think, on Oppenheimer.
Definitely, it was played to a lot of Christopher Nolan's strengths here. So he may be maybe best director, who knows, on this. I think he's kind of gunning for that as well. I do agree, actually. It does weave two kind of narratives. You've got the kind of like the kind of tense, almost cliche race for the atomic bomb to, you know, kind of, we've had these kind of like stories before of, you know, the race to invent the next game changer. But it did remind me also, you've got this kind of this jealousy aspect. It's almost like a film, Amadeus from 1985, where you have maestros, and one is more talented than the other, and then out of this kind of weave jealousy of one, he can come to two nemesis, kind of like weaving.
Kenan Murphy was asked by Christopher Nolan to watch Amadeus to prepare for the role, actually.
Kind of makes sense now. So I can see why, when you don't want to just do that kind of like what you've seen before, this A to B narrative, then you weave this into it as well. It's a good, it's almost like two movies. You could have two separate movies from that, those different aspects. But the first 2 hours, yeah, absolutely. It is tense and done well. So,
I agree with you. Before we I agree with you about that part, actually, but I'm not saying it's a bad last part, but I think that Nolan wanted to be extremely faithful and loyal to the source material, which is kind of an Oppenheimer biography in a way. And obviously, he didn't want to disregard the second life he had after inventing the atom bomb. Mm-hmm. But for an audience perspective, I agree that it's obviously much less interesting than the invention itself. Perhaps, as a movie itself, if he wanted to do like a loose adaptation, if I can use that word, he could have, you're right, maybe focus only on the arms race. And because it's very strange. I thought about it later because I realized that at first, but you have in the movie, you have, spoiler alerts, you have he creates the atom bomb, or he managed to actually to have the first atom bomb test success. And then he switches almost straight away to this part about his supposed communist allegiance or whatever. And then the last 10 minutes, you go back to him having this very famous and super famous now scene with Albert Einstein about the consequence of what is done to the world they live in and also the world we live in. And you would think maybe it would be a better movie if they connect the last scene and the first 2 hours by just focusing on the consequences of creating an atom bomb in a society, in a civilization, and mm-hmm. the arms race, and that Russia went on having the atom bomb like a few years later, and all the other countries that went on, etc. And all of this because of Oppenheimer with like the high point A at the start. That would have been maybe a better movie, but I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it's almost so many aspects, consequences before and after, almost a bit too much for Christopher Nolan to chew on, actually. So that's why I probably felt that third, it could have just warranted a separate movie almost in itself, or a series. But I guess it was too good to resist, really. Best actor, best film, do you think? Or do you think it might be beaten by the first or something else?
If it was up to me, no. But I still believe that actually, as I said before, I think it's between Oppenheimer, Anatomy of a Fall, and Poor Things. Nothing else. That's the three favorites of this year. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know. From the three of them, obviously my personal choice is Anatomy of a Fall, but I don't know if he's going to win. I have a feeling, for some strange reasons, that it will be Oppenheimer because, and we talk about it later, it will be a very, very what's the word? Ballsy choice to choose Poor Things over anything else. Anyway,
best director, you think, for Nolan?
Oh, yeah. I think it's his yeah, year, 100%. Isn't it? And I think actually, in a way, if Greta Gerwig was up for it and didn't get it, there would be a lot of maybe people not happy about that. So it's sort of like it's clear for him to get. And we were saying he's not had an Oscar win for directing before. It's nominated for 13 as well. And I think the most wins for anything is 11. So Titanic, Ben-Hur and Return of the King all got 11 wins. So this could potentially do it. Surely it can't have it can't win nothing, can it? Like with 13 nominations, it's got to get something.
Lord of the Rings was a quick clean sweep, by the way. We talked about clean sweep. Lord of the Rings won every single award we were nominated.
It did. And Titanic was also nominated for three additional things that it didn't win. So, yeah.
Well, as you mentioned, Richard, another film of which you liked immensely was Poor Things. No, Past Lives, sorry. Past Lives.
Past Lives. I found you being sarcastic. So, okay.
Sorry. I don't want.
Yes. Well, you championed this quite early on when we talked about
past lives.
Yes, past lives.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I have to thank again. I did only once, but thank again, James and Alfonso, who talked about this movie first, because I didn't know about this movie even existed before listening to these guys. And then I went to see it. I think 48 hours. After that podcast, and it was such a beautiful movie. Honestly, sometimes I just think about it. I see a picture of as I keep seeing the bar scene at the end, which for me is one of the best acting scene I've ever seen in my life. From the moment actually they went to the bar, it's like 20 minutes of movie, and I thought actually that I was watching literally people, not actors anymore. It's a very beautiful movie. It's a In a way, it's a very simple story, but when you have I have no idea. I need to investigate if these people were not in love in real life, because it's, you feel like actually you're watching actually literally two people actually were in a way maybe meant for one another, but things when got in the way. But it's one of the most beautiful romantic movie I've ever seen in my life. And not only by the way the two main actors, but also the third wheel, in a way, if I may use that word, with the American guy who married one of the two. That guy is actually a supporting actor in the movie The Big Short. I didn't recognize it at first. And honestly, he's very good as well. I realized that after watching the movie, in that third act, he brought me to tears as well, because what he's saying in his position in the situation, he does he's the nice guy, but at the same time he's extremely understandable. And now it's a beautiful movie, and again, because it's a strong year, I have a feeling that he's gonna go home with like no awards whatsoever, and it's a shame. But like a lot of other movies, maybe just being at the ceremony will give some spotlight to that movie, and people will go and watch it, or DVD or streaming or whatever, but because it deserves it. It's such a beautiful movie.
Right.
And it's on Netflix at the moment.
Oh, great. Good. Well deserved, I think. Is it going on the radar? Well, as I mentioned before, I get a big actor nomination or actress nomination comes from Emma Stone in Poor Things, a most fantastical kind of story, kind of like a Frankenstein story, but made it onto the best film list this year, best picture list. Who saw this? Andrew, did you see this? What do you think?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was kind of a quirky film because I had seen some of the director's other films, and this is stands out even amongst those. And I know he's does some unusual films, I guess they're considered unusual, but this is even more. It felt kind of like an R-rated Wes Anderson movie, if that makes any sense. I mean, it's not a Wes Anderson movie. Wes Anderson actually directed, he actually directed one of the live action shorts, so it's not, but that's a whole other story. R-rated Barbie. Yeah, no, it's, but it, just in terms of the aesthetics of it and the look of it, it kind of the quirkiness that Wes Anderson does, but it's not from him. It's actually from Yorgos Lanthimos. So it's kind of like a little take on the, I guess you'd say the Frankenstein story, or Isaiah creating this woman, but then she decides to assert herself, and you know, it kind of goes through her story and all the different things that she goes through and challenging the. I mean, it's a steampunk look, but it's, I guess, supposed to be set in the 1800s, late 1800s, sort of that time period. So challenging that kind of late Victorian era of gender roles and how she kind of deals with that. And then she kind of winds up working in this this brothel in Paris, and then that could have gone any number of ways, and it just kind of uses that to kind of challenge the norms of the time. So, but doing it in this kind of quirky steampunk kind of way. So, I mean, it wasn't something that, you know, would be like an easy watch for a lot of people, you know, something where they can kind of say, oh, this is what's going on, or that. There's a lot of the visuals and the aesthetics are kind of like, can kind of throw people off. And the whole steampunk thing, the idea of like, okay, it's set in the, what looks to be the late 1800s, but then you have what looks like advanced technology for that time, hence the steampunk bit. So, and Emma Stone gives a really good performance. Again, it's kind of between her and, I guess, Lily Gladstone, Best Actress category. It's got nominated for some many of the other categories. I guess Mark Ruffalo, I guess, was nominated. But interestingly enough, William Dafoe was not nominated. But that surprised a lot of people. People expected him to be nominated, but he wasn't.
He's not in it a great deal, is he, actually, compared to Ruffalo? I hadn't thought about that before, but he's kind of in the start, and then he kind of disappears, really.
Well, he maybe stands out when he's in it, so I guess that's what it is.
Yeah, true.
And then I guess there's other actors who kind of, like Rami Youssef. And then there's also another actor who maybe stands out, but I don't know if I should mention because maybe a spoiler. Someone who comes later on in the film.
Yeah, I know.
I know it's a pretty good cast. I thought it was interesting because, you know, here you had a lot of, I guess, U.S. actors pretending to be British. I guess they were supposed to be British. Usually it's the other way around these days. British performers like Christopher Nolan pretending to be American, and here was the other way around. So I don't know, any thoughts on that? I didn't really realize it because it was so otherworldly, the film, that it was like, is it supposed to be British, or is it just supposed to be something that resembles British but in this alternate reality that never really existed? So, and that's something. Because I've seen, again, I've seen this director's other films like The Lobster and Killing of a Sacred Deer, and I haven't seen Dogtooth. I've seen The Favourite, which is supposed to be based on real events, but not quite. You know, Queen Anne was a real person, but this is even more weird than that. So than any of those other films, that's saying something. As I said, I like the film, but it may not be for everyone because of the whole weird aesthetics of it. So this is my take.
It's kind of a little quirky.
That's the reason why I'm asking you, Andrew, that as you said, last thing you said exactly what I'm thinking is, it's not for everyone. And do you think that because it's not for everyone, but it has a shot of winning Best Picture? Because that was my main comment. Because it doesn't matter, actually, if I thought it was too much sex or not, etc. It doesn't matter what my opinion, but I'm pretty sure that a lot of people actually were disturbed by the fact that they didn't expect to have so much sex scene. But I wonder actually if the Academy will give the Best Picture award to a movie like this or not. And I'm just being honestly wondering. I don't care, but I'm just being wondering.
Well, I mean, they may not go to it for other reasons. It may not have to do with, I mean, yeah, maybe a tough sell to the Academy anyway, but I think, yeah, if you have like Oppenheimer, it's not just that Oppenheimer is a big blockbuster that made a lot of money. It's also that, you know, Christopher Nolan's been snubbed for a long time and he's kind of due, and it's a historical drama about an important topic. There's a lot of other things. And then you have Killers of the Flower Moon with the indigenous and dealing with problems facing the indigenous community in the US. And there's a lot of other things at play here than just like, oh, Poor Things is not a safe choice. I mean, which could be, but there's a lot of other things at play. So,
and it also has crossed 100 million at the international. I mean, the global.
Yeah, that's not an easy thing.
It is not so for. It's not so niche as it seems.
Yeah, I agree, Alfonso. I think like Yorgos Lanthimos. What's his? Thank you. You say it better than me. I was literally staring at the name and opened my mouth and rubbish come out. The thing is about him as a director, I really loved The Favourite, and that was the first film I'd seen of his. But maybe if this was his first film, this wouldn't have crossed over. But actually, and when I was reviewing this on the monthly one, I was saying, oh, this isn't for everyone, this isn't for everyone. But actually, it's a weird kind of contradiction here because it is quite niche in some ways, but it's made more money than Madame Web. Now, maybe that says something about Madame Web isn't a very high bar. But you've got the thing that actually there is maybe an audience appetite. When there's so much stuff that sort of looks similar to each other, people want something that's a bit different. And although this is quite quirky, it is a kind of Frankenstein tale. It's a very well-known tale in a sense, and it's kind of a dark twisted version of that, and it has sort of found an audience. It's not even played that much in the UK. It was quite difficult to find like showings of it, but it seems to have caught on. And I mean, the Academy obviously like it that they've given it 11 nominations, so apart from Oppenheimer, it's the most nominated film. So there is an appetite for it. It isn't going to be for everyone. But I think the thing with The Favourite is, and why that really rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way, is it looked like a costume drama, but it's actually like a very black comedy. Whereas this is a Frankenstein story, and it's a proper, like, messed up Frankenstein story. And Frankenstein is a horror, isn't it? So,
well, if you've seen this director's other films, you kind of understand
think that's the key, is that now people with this director's name that I can't pronounce, but people know what those films are going to be like now. And I think The Lobster's brilliant. I only caught up with that after
I love The Lobster.
It's so good. But I think actually from having seen his other work, I was kind of prepared for how weird it was. In a good way, but I loved it.
My point was only that usually, and I'm not talking about the other nominations, but only the nomination for Best Picture, the one who wins the Best Picture usually, obviously, on Monday morning will get the big titles, you know, in the newspapers, etc. And because of that, unless I'm mistaken, and it's very possible I'm mistaken, but actually the Academy thinks about that, actually, that when they give the Best Picture, they either try to send a message or they try to give it to something like important, so actually people talk about the Oscar ceremony. I'm thinking about Spotlight was won because it was a very big moment because it shone some light on a big important matter or other stuff like that. If they give to Poor Things, I'm not saying it doesn't deserve it. I'm just saying that then perhaps afterwards there might be discussions that say, okay, that's a very strange show by the Academy, etc. It might backfire on them. I don't know.
There was a guy who was involved, who used to be involved with this stuff last year, and he was saying that historically it always used to be a mix. The best way to sort of do it was to do a mix of recognizing big box office success and things that have been real big, like indie hits on the kind of film festival circuit. And that's probably a good shout. I do think if they give it something too obscure, like I loved Past Lives, but if Past Lives won Best Picture, I feel there would be a lot of kickback from people going, well, I've not heard of this film. Oh, it's too small to be a Best Picture. So it was sort of why last year I really didn't want Banshees of Inisherin to win against Everything Everywhere All at Once. I love both films, but I was like, if Banshees wins this, people are going to really hate it for winning. So I think it's, you don't want it to just be Barbie wins everything, I don't think, because Barbie's already biggest film of last year. You want a little bit of recognition. It's almost like advertising, I think, of the Oscars for people that don't watch films. Obviously, we watch films all the time. We know these things. But it's a good way for the people who don't watch to sort of go, what's been out this year? What should I check out? And kind of just throw a few names out there. But and it's interesting looking over the winners over the last 100 years almost of, or 96 years of Oscar winners. And sometimes you go, yeah, I remember that was a massive film that year. And there's other years when you look at it and go, what? I don't know that, but I've never heard of that film. You know, and I don't think that's good to do something so obscure that nobody's watched it. But you sort of want it to be something somewhere in the middle. And maybe Poor Things is in that sweet spot, you know, but we'll see. Because it's sci-fi and fantasy as well. That's the thing, isn't it? And it's kind of, I think that's why Everything Everywhere really got so many wins last year, because it was sci-fi, but it was original. It wasn't just sort of like a trotted out IP. So
yeah. You think about The Shape of Water.
Which I loved. I know Richard doesn't, but I love that.
Not that you don't like it. I say that Guillermo del Toro did better in the past, but
Poor Things has more. Even though it is, both are like some kind of fantasy, I think Poor Things has a little bit more a foot in some real theme, like the sexual awakening and liberation of a woman. But it is more or less the same with The Shape of Water, but with a fish. But it's like,
that's last.
And about 10 minutes less of sex scenes, but yeah.
Well, yes, we'll see. Right. Well, finally, we come to our last film. That is The Zone of Interest. This is a World War II little situation or comedy. Well, not comedy, but rather it's based on the book, I think, Martin Amis' book, kind of a contingency. But now, James, you saw this. Do you think it's worth, quite powerful, very kind of like very worthy of being on this? And do you think it will?
I do think it's worthy of being on the list. I think it's a very different nomination to the other films. Yeah, I mean, I know Jonathan Glazer. I can't say any directors' names, even English directors' names. Jonathan Glazer's other work he did, Under the Skin, which is a really good film. This is very eerie, so it's sort of set in the house adjacent to Auschwitz with the commandant of Auschwitz, and it sort of focuses on his home life as things in the background that you know are terrible happen. But you don't ever go into those places. And I think it was Alfonso flagged the rating on this. So this is a 12A in the UK. So I was like, this isn't going to go somewhere horrific. It's going to maintain this, the way that it does this, all the way through the film. I do understand that it's probably not a great film like to go and see in the evening as well, because I know a few people have gone to see it. And it's, I mean, I went to see The Iron Claw recently, and I think that's a very good film, but I do not recommend going to see that in the evening, because it's just a lot, and this film is quite a lot, I think. But I did find something about it. I know these stories have been told a lot of times in the past. I mean, for a start, I think the sound design on this is fantastic. Sandra Hüller again is absolutely fantastic in this. So she's been in two sort of amazing films this year. But the sort of eeriness of it, and I think it's a very different film to other films about World War II that I've seen, because I think it's just trying to remind us, and I know we know this, but evil doesn't always look like Darth Vader. And I feel, having watched one of the best documentary nominations, which is 20 Days in Mariupol, which is the hands down the most horrific documentary I've ever seen in my life, about the initial invasion of Ukraine. And there is something about watching footage that confronting that you kind of want to look away, and you know that I was kind of watching a documentary, like just wanting to look away, and I shouldn't be, you know, I feel like I should be watching that film. But I think in the instance of this, it kind of made me think about the war in a different way. It's always felt like something very distant to me. And I think being the age I am now, and that it was less than, you know, I'm in my 40s now. I know, shocking, isn't it? But I'm in my 40s now. And like, there was less than 40 years between my birth and when World War II ended. And suddenly it feels like it's closer in some weird way. And that, you know, it the people that were complicit in that probably saw themselves as not as villains. You know, I think that's the thing that I found quite unnerving about this. But I know it's not for everyone. I know it's a very sort of, because of the nature of what it's trying to do, it's not plot driven, and it's not full of, you know, sort of arcs and massive moments. It's kind of almost like a sort of a piece of art in that sense. And I hate saying that because it sounds pretentious, but I do think in this, it's almost like, I mean, you've just listened to me try and explain this film very badly. If you watch the film, it makes sense. I think that's when a film's really good, is that you can try and make that point. A bit like actors, they can try and explain what the performance is, but when they just do it, you kind of go, oh, right, it's that. So I thought it was really good. And actually, the weird thing is I could watch this again. I've heard some people go, I never want to see that film again in my life. I don't feel that way about it because there's nothing in it that is as confronting, I think, as another film could be. But it is a film, and other people have not enjoyed it as much. And I will pass the baton now to someone who hasn't.
Okay. Thanks for that, James. Anyone else saw that?
I'll let Andrew speak first if she wants to put a smile on.
Yeah. This time I think, oh, it hasn't said already. Again, it's another film with Sandra Hüller. So I guess this seems to be a big year for her. I think it's, because in the past, there's always this tendency to kind of have, like, you know, one film dealing with the Holocaust, at least among the nominees. This year I can think of at least two. One is Letter to a Pig, which is one of the animated shorts. But here it's kind of, and I guess James was saying it before, that yeah, you're not really focusing on what's actually going on in Auschwitz directly. You're kind of, you know what's going on there, and you know what's going on there. I guess they presume that people already know, have a working knowledge about the Holocaust and what happened at Auschwitz, so they don't really need to show stuff, they don't need to be explicit, but you know what's going on. And other than the smoke plumes coming out in the back around the ash, it's just the idea of the whole banality of evil, that whole thing. So it's kind of a different take on that story, so it might not be an easy watch for people. I'm trying to think the exact title of this. It was a documentary called The Act of Killing. That was the name of it.
Yeah.
It was about this genocide that was going on in Indonesia. It was a documentary. I think it was a nominated Best Feature Documentary several years ago. But also that was not an easy watch because you're kind of seeing these people who were involved in the genocide, involved in these killings, and just kind of being casually describing it, talking about all these ways about it. And that makes it hard watch because it's like, are you supposed to sympathize or empathize or whatever with these people? And people's like, I don't want to see that. I want you to finger wag. I want you to say, oh, this was bad. What you did was bad. Sometimes people don't own up to it. They just kind of say, well, you know, that's what happened, you know? And from what I understand, the book that Zone of Interest was based on, they didn't really name names. They kind of knew what it was about, who they were referring to. But here they kind of went and named the names of the people who were involved and were behind it. And the people who, like the offspring of the people who were about, was like, oh, this is really harsh. How could you say this about this person, about this is my family? So it took like a couple generations for people to kind of come out and be like, yeah, this is what was done was wrong. And, you know, we own up to it, what our ancestors did. So the realization that, you know, people kind of supported even long afterwards what happened, and or at least didn't own up to it. You know, that's kind of a tougher thing to do.
And, yeah. Richard, your kind of thoughts on this?
Yeah. I try to phrase the way I feel about this movie. First of all, I think that, again, a bit like what I said about Killers of the Flower Moon, I just checked the name of the actor, the main actor of this movie, called in German actor called Christian Friedel, and I think he should have been nominated for Best Actor instead of Bradley Cooper. But that's my opinion, because if he deserves it a million times more, because when I was watching, I wasn't very impressed with Sandra Hüller's performance. I don't think that she has a scene that is memorable. But this guy, unfortunately, this guy for him, he was doing so well that I felt like I was watching like literally the leader of Auschwitz in his private life. And that's terrible. That's actually a good sign, because it means actually he did a good job. But that was really difficult to watch or listen to what he was saying, especially in the last part of the movie. Now, the movie itself, I kind of follow up on what James was saying. I don't think it's a well done movie as a movie, because of the topic he decides to focus on the life in the end of a family that happens to be a family of living next to Auschwitz, and a family of the commander of Auschwitz, and obviously a family that is extremely xenophobic. And so if that was the goal, yeah, fair enough. But I think as a movie itself, it's like as an artistic piece, it was just a decent movie. Now, my second part of my thoughts is that that I follow you more on what Ento was saying. If you want to do a movie about the Holocaust and about World War II and the Final Solution, obviously there have been a lot of movies and TV shows about that before. And in my opinion, and that's a personal thing, if I want to see a movie like this, I want this movie to either be of a shocking value, or in a good way, but actually it shocks you, and in a way that actually when you look at it, when you watch it, after you leave the movie theater, you think about it for hours, days, etc. And it means actually that the mission is complete. It must be like this, because it's so important that people know about this and are shocked about what happened in the 40s. And also, it must teach you something for people actually who missed school or have a lack of education, or maybe also some people who are not very smart, so actually who need actually a lesson about exactly what people, how people suffered in the 1940s. All of that I didn't see in Zone of Interest, I'm afraid. I don't think actually that compared to other movies about concentration camps, I don't think he did this great mission in a good, great way, if I don't know how to phrase it. I think that movies like La Vita è Bella, the Roberto Benigni, or especially the two last episodes of Band of Brothers, a TV show produced by Spielberg back in the day, did a better job, because definitely when you watch these things, it sticks in your mind, and it must stick in your mind. In that case, in the case of Stones of Interest, honestly, I don't. There's nothing huge, but I try to understand what the message here is. I don't think there is a message, and that's the saddest part. We're talking about one of the worst crime against humanity, And I don't think there is a message here, except that, yes, that this is the life or the private life or a family where the Nazis is the father. Okay. But I thought it was lacking something.
Can I add a coda from Maestro of all things? So the only thing I like about Maestro, well, like I said, there's a few things. There's a thing at the start where it says, the job of a piece of art is to ask questions and not propose the answers. And I think that film, I know what you mean, because I think people do want like historical things to sort of have a message and tell us where we've gone wrong. I don't think Jonathan Glazer really knows. I think he's kind of sort of saying, look, this kind of happened and it's not as, I mean, I wouldn't use the word empathy. I don't think it's trying to be empathetic at all to the characters you see. I think it's more sort of saying that these people would view themselves not as the bad guys, and they clearly are. And that it is, I keep saying it, but that thing of not being Darth Vader, you know, it's sort of be on the lookout for people, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing, that kind of thing, that when evil turns up, it's probably not going to announce itself as evil. I think that's what, if the film has any kind of message, I think it's that, but I don't know.
Thanks, James, for that. Yes, well, quite, thank you. I think we kind of covered these, what, 10 nominations or counting.
How was Nimona, Richard? Did you watch that earlier? Because that is nominated for Best Animated Feature.
Yeah, I fell asleep, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I swear. Nothing, yeah. I got nothing against this movie, but I mean, yes, in a way, yes, I do actually.
I think Spider-Verse will probably win that or when Boy you look and at Heron.
When you look at this category, I mean, I watched, I think, 45 minutes of it, and I literally fell asleep. I'm sorry. Just woke up back at 5 in the morning. I said, do I want to watch the ending before I go to work? No. My apologies. Nimona. It's not.
Yeah, eventually it was Netflix, but initially it started out as a Disney production.
Okay.
And they had a lot of work that had been done on it, but then Disney decided not to go through with finishing it. So then it kind of just was in limbo for a couple of years, and then Netflix picked it up. So it wasn't initially Netflix, but it eventually made its way to Netflix. That's what happened.
The funny thing is that I think that Netflix is desperate now, because when you look at the movie, and that's a personal opinion again, it looks like a random animated movie that you would watch with your children on the Saturday morning. And that doesn't mean that it's bad. Huh? I mean, it's fun to watch it with your family. But again, seeing this as an Oscar-nominated animated feature, it's kind of a joke, to be honest. I don't know. I mean, I think that Netflix is desperate, because I saw a week ago that you can see it for free on YouTube, and that's not illegal.
Netflix
did that just to actually to try to make it known. So actually, maybe, I don't know, they tried what they can actually to steal an award here. But I mean, when you look at this category, I think it's pretty obvious that who are the two, maybe three favorites, and Nimona is not one of them.
Like the Boy and the Heron.
Yeah, the Boy and the Heron. Maybe Spider-Man, because it's a big name of animation. It's great animation, to be honest. So yeah, I think it's one of these two. So yeah,
right. Well, it's quite a selection here. Quickly, we'll just go around as we finish. Who do you want to win the best picture?
Who do we want, or who do we
pick? So Richard, just name who you had to pick.
Who one. I want, obviously, and Anthony of the Fall. But who's gonna win, in my opinion? I would go for Oppenheimer.
Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing, because at this point, you pretty much know, because of the precursors and the momentum, it's probably going to be Oppenheimer. If I had to pick the ones that were actually nominated, I would probably say The Holdovers.
I would pick Poor Things. And I think it's going to win. I mean, if you look at the precursors awards, it's going to be Oppenheimer. But I hope it's anything else just to piss off my coworker.
Your coworker?
Yeah.
Because well,
my former co-worker, who is also a film reviewer, and because in November I was like, I think it's gonna be Poor Things, and he was like, no, it's gonna be Killers of the Flower Moon or Oppenheimer. And now he's like, every time Oppenheimer wins an award, he's like, you see, I was right. I was like, I hope anything else other than Oppenheimer wins.
Well, yeah, maybe that's probably.
What about you, Jason?
Oh, it's going to be either Maestro or Barbie. And then we'll end.
Probably just Maestro.
For the win, for the surprise. But even though I made a criticism of Oppenheimer, I guess it's just going to be a bit more his year, and having Best Director and then not. I don't know. But I wouldn't mind if Oppenheimer did win. But I think Christopher Nolan probably, his time for Best Director probably this year. I think so. But we'll see. Anyway, on that note, thanks to our regulars, Andrew, James, Alfonso, and Richard. Thank you for this special, and we'll see you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this film and TVReview.com episode. Catch the latest film and TV reviews, together with regular episode content from the world of film and TV every week. See you soon. Would you like to reach our film and TV review podcast audience? Do you have a product or service of interest to film and TV home consumers or followers of the entertainment industry? Have a film or show production to publicize? For affordable price plans for all budgets, get in touch and find out about our introductory advertising options. Reach our audience of film and TV viewers and visit our site contact page at filmandtvreview.com, or you can email us at business@filmandtvreview.com. Reach out today.